The March of Time. Today, Time, the weekly news magazine, celebrates its 16th birthday.
16 years ago this week was published the first issue of Time. It was a new kind of magazine, the world's first news magazine. On its cover, the man of the week, the bearded face of longtime Speaker of the House, Uncle Joe Cannon. Inside, it was arranged exactly as a copy of Time is today, in systematic, organized departments for cover-to-cover reading. The first paragraph of this first issue of Time began,
"Seeking only the nation's welfare, Mr. Harding has suffered defeat at the hands of Congress. Not only that, but the man who was elected president by the largest plurality in history has been reproved by a Congress controlled by his own party."
So Time began with a story of a rebellion of Congress against President Harding. And in that issue, Time also reported the retirement of beloved Uncle Joe Cannon and the strange doings of the new Italian premier, Benito Mussolini. Recorded the efforts of young Franklin D. Roosevelt to organize a dirigible airline from New York to Chicago. Reviewed a new Chaplin movie, The Pilgrim, and a new play called Rain. In all, told 103 timely and memorable stories from the news of the week.
Time's first issue went to 9,000 subscribers. Crude by today's standards, it had but 28 pages with few photographs and no color plates. Nevertheless, it contained all the essential news of that first week of March 1923 in brief, readable form. And each week thereafter, as Time grew up, more and more readers became more and more devoted to the world's first news magazine.
Today, more than 700,000 American families read Time each week. And inevitably, the experience of 16 years has made Time better and better, broadened its scope and its resources, enabled it continually to perfect its essential service. For never has Time swerved from its original single purpose, to keep intelligent men and women well informed, to enable the busy American to get all the real news every week, grasp it, put it together, make it his own.
This week, to mark Time's 16th birthday, the publishers are offering March of Time listeners facsimile reproductions of the original first issue of Time. Only 2,000 are available, reproduced in full.
If you would like a free facsimile of this collector's item of U.S. journalism, the original first issue of Time, just drop a card with your request tonight to Time, Chicago, Illinois. Your copy will be mailed to you without cost. Simply address the card to Time, Chicago, Illinois. The new issue of Time, with all the news of all the world of this week, is on sale at your nearest newsstand tonight.
Tonight, Time, the weekly news magazine, raises the curtain again on its reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From the March of Time.
Gentlemen of the jury, the district attorney is asking you to convict this man sitting here, an honored man, a true man, and a friend. This old man who went to war for his country. Like the greatest figure in the world, he sat down with publicans and sinners. But before God, Jimmy Hines never participated in this conspiracy. My client has been patented.
This week in the New York courtroom of Judge Charles C. Knott, Jr., the most sensational political trial of the decade is drawing to its close. The trial of James J. Hines, charged with protecting Manhattan's gangster-operated policy racket. Lawyer Lloyd Paul Stryker for the defense has begun his summation to the jury. District Attorney Thomas Edmund Dewey is scribbling notes on a pad. And directly opposite him, the defendant, James J. Hines, looks at his hands abstractedly. The jury sits in rapt attention. But in the eyes of one of their number, there are tears. And there are tears in the eyes of many a spectator as Lloyd Paul Stryker nears the end of his address.
It was a wrong, a great and a grave wrong, to put two beady-eyed rats like George Weinberg and Dixie Davis in the same prison cell to plot to obtain their freedom by framing an innocent man. I've done all I could to blast these rattlesnakes. God help me, I wish I'd done a better job. But gentlemen of the jury, keep for this old man his liberty. The last stand of liberty is here. Strike a blow for liberty. Come back from the jury room with a verdict to which the church bells may ring on Sunday morning. Not guilty, not guilty, not guilty.
Lloyd Satisfied, Paul Stryker ends his summation, and the case for the defense is closed. Next day, in the courtroom of Judge Knott, Prosecutor Thomas E. Dewey rises to address the jury.
Gentlemen of the jury, the fact that Mr. Hines is an old man is not the point of this case. The fact that he fought for his country is not the point of this case. The fact that, in the opinion of the defense attorney, he resembles a certain great man who sat down with publicans and sinners is not the point of this case. The point is that James J. Hines was the leader of a corrupt alliance of organized crime and politics in New York City. Sentence in this case is...
Cautiously and logically, Thomas Dewey presents the facts. Carefully, unhurriedly, he reviews the testimony in the case that he has built with relentless logic toward inevitable conclusion. In the courtroom, defendant Jimmy Hines is sitting with a fixed, frozen grin on his face. Mrs. Hines rises and quietly leaves the room as Prosecutor Dewey closes his case.
The important thing in this case is this, that you declare to the people of New York, the police of New York, that they are free, that they won't any longer be betrayed by a corrupt alliance between crime and politics, that alliance is going to be smashed by this jury. You must remove the cancers that grow at the heart of your government, that wreck the morale of your police force, that wreck the morale of your court, and that wreck the morale of any public official who has come within the contaminating influence of a politician operating with gangsters' money in the background. Here is the thing which makes organized crime possible. You can help to make organized crime impossible by bringing a verdict of guilty against the defendant, James J. Hines.
Gentlemen of the jury, have you agreed upon a verdict?
We have. Guilty.
As to the first count of the indictment, how do you find?
Guilty.
As to the second count of the indictment?
Guilty.
This week, to question after question, comes the reply guilty. As old-style politician James J. Hines is convicted on all 13 counts of his indictment, faces a possible sentence of 25 years in the penitentiary. And facing the United States political front this week is a new-style, potent-looking political face, the face of the man who jailed Jimmy Hines, young Republican District Attorney Thomas Edmund Dewey. For this week, national survey on the 1940 election shows that leading the field of the non-democratic candidates with as many votes as his two nearest competitors combined is New York District Attorney Thomas Edmund Dewey. Time marches on. For more than a generation, Viennese waltz best loved by all Germans has been Franz Lehár's Merry Widow. But this week in Greater Germany, a merrier Merry Widow takes an official bow by order of the bachelor leader of the Third German Reich.
To Miss Marianne Daniels, the Cannes Casino of France, Fräulein. It is the wish of Reichsführer Adolf Hitler that you come to Munich at once to give your own interpretation of the Merry Widow waltz. An airplane will be provided for your convenience.
Next night, the stage of Munich's Gotteplatz Theater. In progress is a command performance of Adolf Hitler's favorite light opera, Franz Lehár's Merry Widow. The dancers, lissom, long-limbed, 19-year-old Marion Daniels, acrobatic tap dancer of California. Most pleased spectator, Reichsführer Adolf Hitler. A few moments later, dancer Daniels is conducted to the box of Reichsführer Adolf Hitler.
Fräulein Daniels. Es freut mich.
Heil Hitler.
Die lustige Witwe, wie Sie es getanzt haben, war wunderschön.
I'm so sorry, Chancellor Hitler, but I don't understand German.
The Führer said, Miss Daniels, that your performance of the Merry Widow was the finest he had ever seen.
Oh.
Das Fräulein spricht ein Beispiel.
Das ist schade.
Thank you, Mr. Hitler.
Sagen Sie ihr, dass sie einen wunderbaren Körperrhythmus hat.
The Führer says you have a wonderful movement of the body. That is
That is the motion of the legs.
Yes.
A bewegung, a rhythmus.
A rhythm, if you mean.
Oh, uh-huh. Oh, you must mean my flexes. Like this. Flexes.
Flexes.
Mr. Hitler was terribly nice and polite, and later I did a specialty number for him and some of his friends at a nightclub. Only, of course, my mother went with me. I never go anywhere without mother.
That's the Hitler headline of the week, made by a youthful U.S. woman tap dancer. But this week, halfway around the earth, from Adolf Hitler's Germany, another woman performer makes a different kind of news. In San Jose, California, one evening this week, 3,000 persons jammed the Civic Auditorium to hear a world-famed contralto, Marian Anderson. Awaiting her entrance on the stage, singer Anderson is standing in the wings beside her manager.
Everything all right, Miss Anderson?
Oh, yes, I'm all right.
Good house.
How's the booking coming along?
Well, it's not...
What's the matter?
Oh, it'll keep. I'll tell you after the performance, Miss Anderson.
No, tell me now.
Well, it's just a little change in schedule, that's all.
What's the change?
Well, I had a wire from Washington today. We're canceling there.
Canceling? Well, I thought it was all arranged that I was to sing at Constitution Hall.
Oh, they're booked for April 9th.
Well, can't we get another night?
Miss Anderson, it seems the Daughters of the American Revolution own the hall, and they won't let colored people appear there.
Oh. Oh, I see.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry. We've never run into anything like
that. That's all right. It's all right.
Miss Anderson. Are you ready, Miss Anderson?
Yes, I'm ready.
Slowly walking out on the stage, Marian Anderson bows slightly to her applauding audience. Then... Anna Eleanor Roosevelt resigns from the Daughters of the American Revolution in protest against the ban of Marian Anderson from Constitution Hall. Recalling perhaps a judgment disclosed 4 years ago by musician Arturo Toscanini.
A voice like a Marian Anderson is heard once in 100 years.
Time marches on. Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes. All persons having business before the Honorable the Supreme Court of the United States are admonished...
In the hushed chamber of the U.S. Supreme Court, 8 justices file to their places behind the bench. Bearded Chief Justice Charles Evans Hughes, as is his custom, launches without preamble into the business of the day. Then, one by one, the spectators sit up in their places and lean forward, for the Chief Justice is reading the long-expected decision on the Penn Steel sit-down strike.
In this case, the National Labor Relations Board asks this court to uphold a board order requiring a corporation to reinstate workers, which is discharged for participating in a sit-down strike. In our opinion, the seizure of property by sit-down strikers is a high-handed proceeding without shadow of legal right. The existence of unfair labor practices by employers cannot justify it. This court, therefore, upholds the decision of the lower court that the Fan Steel Corporation is under no obligation to rehire employees who engaged in the so-called sit-down strike.
This week, from the bench of the U.S. Supreme Court, a decision outlawing in no uncertain terms the sit-down strike, rebuking in no less certain terms the New Deal's National Labor Relations Board. And this week, as national polls report only 19% of the U.S. electorate in favor of adding more New Deal reform legislation, faced with need for a major political realignment of the administration of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal. Promptly this week, Secretary of the Treasury Morgenthau promises to avoid new taxes, reform old. Franklin Roosevelt himself extends an olive branch to business. But biggest political sound-off this week comes not from Washington, but from Little Grinnell, Iowa.
Well, folks, it sure is heartwarming to see all your familiar faces again. This welcome touches me. I'm happy to be back in Iowa. Iowa. It's nice to be home.
Number one political fence builder and rumored 1940 presidential choice of Franklin Roosevelt this week is Harry Hopkins. And as Grinnell, Iowa greets its favorite prodigal son, off for his baptism of fire as a politician is hopeful Harry Hopkins. First stop, a basketball game at Grinnell College. Political objective, the local boy touch.
To you, Mr. Barry, as captain of the basketball team, it gives me great pleasure to present this fine, this blanket.
Thank you.
I hope you get in there and fight. When I played on this team, they used to call me Dirty Hopkins. Of course, I was very ambitious as a boy.
All right, fellas, how about it? Hip, hip.
Grinnell! 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 Rah! 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 Rah!
Hopkins!
Touch Harry Hopkins' American homespun, old hometown political holiday. But that night, Harry Hopkins' expression is serious and thoughtful as he faces the first citizens of Iowa and a brace of microphones as well. The word has gone out that this is to be no run-of-the-mind cabinet member's speech, but an important pronouncement of government policy. Solemnly, deliberately, Harry Hopkins begins to speak.
I am glad to be back in Iowa tonight. I was born and raised here. My father and mother spent their lives here. I realize full well...
Thus, with the common touch, begins Harry Hopkins. Then, his tone changing, he begins to hammer home, point after point, a drastically altered New Deal philosophy. Keynote of the Hopkins speech.
It is a hard, stubborn fact that among many businessmen, there exists a widespread lack of confidence. The administration, in an effort to face that fact, has shifted the emphasis from reform to recovery.
Harry Hopkins on labor.
Business is finding it increasingly difficult to progress in the face of a divided labor front. Government is doing what it can to end that division.
Harry Hopkins on taxes.
I believe any federal taxes which freeze the necessary flow of capital should be amended. To hire workers, businessmen have to make money.
Harry Hopkins, conclusion.
Tonight, I have tried to state our objectives as forcefully as I can. That it is our determination to make every move we know how to promote recovery and get people back to work on private jobs.
Such the most outspoken New Deal bid to U.S. businessmen and taxpayers since the famed Roosevelt breathing spell of 1935. The most open bid to date for the job of heading Franklin Roosevelt's party in 1940. Next day, up goes the stock market in response to Harry Hopkins' speech. By wireless from the cruiser Houston, Franklin Roosevelt makes a quick follow-up in his campaign for political appeasement. A firm demand for peace negotiations between warring labor lions William Green and John L. Lewis, possibly with Franklin Roosevelt himself as mediator. But still facing Franklin Roosevelt and his nation this week is a problem on which the only person in U.S. public life with the courage or inclination to speak her mind, is the wife of Franklin Roosevelt. In an address to the youth of the U.S., says Anna Eleanor Roosevelt,
security for youth and for age is the fundamental problem still facing our country today. We've done things which have helped to answer that question, but we've been afraid to face the fact that this problem is economic and that none of us knows the answer. Some countries feel they have found the answer, but we do not agree because we do not like the form their answers have taken. Now, I believe in Social Security and old age pensions and public works, but never as a fundamental answer, simply as something which gives hope. They are stopgaps. There is no use kidding ourselves. this problem goes down to the roots of whether civilization goes on or civilization dies. It is nothing new for a civilization to come to an end. It is just a question of whether we have the brains to keep it from happening, and the determination, and the character, and the unselfishness.
Time marches on. Rockefeller Center, New York, the newsroom of the National Broadcasting Company.
Hello, NBC. It's white smoke. They've elected a pope.
When do you expect it to hit?
About half an hour. They're in there dressing him and so forth now.
Have you got a monitor on the Vatican?
Don't need it. We've got to cut in on the direct loop to the balcony.
Okay. Keep talking and feeding till we get the name. Got anyone to talk?
You got a Monsignor.
Okay, he'll do.
This week, through the casual medium of modern communications, the world hears news of the culmination of a 700-year-old ritual. Here's reported for the first time in history by the wondrous devices of a new era, an ancient sign of the church to its people. For a jet of white smoke is curling from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel, the anxiously awaited signal that a successor has been elected to the 2,000-year-old throne of St. Peter. In Rome, in the great piazza before St. Peter's, are gathered the humble folk of the eternal city that cradled the Christian faith in the Western world. Gathered as had their Roman ancestors in centuries past, to greet the successor to the office that once ruled the Catholic world in fact, as well as in spirit. A great throng waits anxiously, eyes on the balcony high above the square. Then at 6:07, Cardinal Caccia Dominioni, deaner of the Order of Cardinal Deacons, steps out upon the balcony of St. Peter's.
Annuncio vobis gaudium magnum ab Deus Patrem. Eminentissimum ad reverendissimum Dominum, Dominum Eterneum. Sancte Romani Ecclesiae, Casa nale merugine spaziale. Quistim in nomen impossuit pium.
I give you tidings of great joy. We have a pope, the most eminent and reverend Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, who has taken upon himself the name of Pius the 12th. The great bell of St. Peter's, last rung in mourning for Pius the 11th, rings out to the solemn chant of the Te Deum. But as dusk deepens over St. Peter's, from the front of the reverent throng, it can be seen that the curtains are being parted at the rear of the balcony. The Te Deum breaks up. The tall, erect figure in ermine-trimmed pontifical cap and robe makes his way to the balustrade, his hands raised in benediction. This week, new pontiff looks down from the balcony of St. Peter's and out upon the rejoicing members of his flock and gives his benediction to Rome and to the world. For on this second day of March 1939, plain Eugenio Pacelli has assumed the awesome burden of infallibility. That in his priestly office as shepherd of some 300 million souls, the words of Eugenio Pacelli are the words of God. When Eugenio Pacelli was born, on a March 2nd, 63 years ago, his church had but 6 years before defined, for the first time, the divine inspiration of its popes. When Eugenio Pacelli was a young priest, his predecessor, Leo XIII, set a precedent of speaking to the world in his divine authority. Spoke out against the tragic plight of poor men made poorer by the crushing growth of an industrial machine. As Eugenio Pacelli grew in stature as a churchman, he heard in 1914 the voice of Benedict XV speak out divinely to avert the most terrible war of man and his machines the world has ever known. Heard 2 decades later, his own Pius XI, whom he served as Secretary of State, sanction a war fought by steel-clad tank and aerial bombs in a Catholic country across the Mediterranean. This week, speaking to the world over airwaves which have raised dictators and new heresies against his faith, Eugenio Pacelli, as Pius XII, assumes the burden of speaking henceforth with the infallible voice of the Vicar of Christ on earth. The heavy responsibility of raising that voice to the unpredictable years which lie ahead, against enemies such as no leader of his faith has ever had to face in all the centuries of the Holy Roman Church.
In these troublesome and difficult hours, we raise to God a special prayer for all those who are entrusted with the high honor and the grave burden of guiding peoples on the road to prosperity, to progress, and to peace.
Time marches on. Tonight at this week's end, the memorable events which the march of time has reenacted and which this week pass in review in the pages of Time, the weekly news magazine, take their place in history. In Europe, a new pope inheriting the power of the church and its destiny in Europe's continuing crisis. In the United States, news of a fundamental shift of national government policy, changes which will have an inevitable effect on this country and the world. Time has been called the most important magazine in America, because it enables intelligent men and women not only to know all the news of all the world every week. Time enables you to understand each week's news in relation to what has gone before, to see ahead, to have a true understanding of the news that is happening to you. News that will affect your work, your income, the way you live, perhaps even how long you will live.
For 16 years, that has been the one and only purpose of Time, the weekly news magazine. This week, to mark its 16th anniversary, Time offers March of Time listeners facsimile copies of its original first issue, published March 3rd, 1923. Only 2,000 of these facsimile copies are available. To get your copy, just drop a card to Time, Chicago, Illinois, and it will be mailed to you without cost.
For all the news of all the world, read Time, the weekly news magazine. This week's new issue is on sale at your nearest newsstand tonight. Time marches on.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.